Okay, wonderful. I was saying that I'm with a couple of my chemistry students. This time is during one of my chemistry class, and I decided to allow them to see how an interview would be conducted for writing a research paper. Is that all right with you?
That's fine. How many students are there?
About five.
Five in what grade?
They're 10th graders and 11th graders.
5th and 11th?
10th, 11th, and actually we have two 9th graders, three 9th graders, one 10th grader and one 11th grader.
Okay, great, sure.
Okay, one.
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you. So, my first question would be, exactly what is Space Adventures' plan for bringing about a commercial space travel program for tourists from right now where we are in the beginning of 2011, let's say on to about 2021. What have you all done already, and what are you all planning to do in the next 10 years?
Okay, so if we look historically, it just so happens that Space Adventures is celebrating the 10th anniversary of our client's first flight to the International Space Station. And what I mean by that is that in 2001, a businessman from California paid $20 million to travel. He used his own money to pay for a ticket to travel to the International Space Station. And he spent approximately 8 days aboard the space station living there with the professional cosmonauts and astronauts. The space station orbits our Earth about 240 miles above the surface. It's traveling at about 17,000 miles an hour. It orbits the Earth every 90 minutes. Dennis Tito, who was our first client, he saw a sunrise and a sunset every 90 minutes, so we experienced 16 of those sunrises and sunsets every day. Now, since then, since that first flight, we've had 7 additional missions. It just so happens that one of our clients flew twice. A man by the name of Charles Simone, he flew in 2007, and he liked it so much that he flew again in 2009. Now, to go on to your follow-on question, what do we see for the next 10 years and what we hope for commercial space travel in general is that we feel as though we're only taking the first step, and that first step is allowing people the opportunity, non-career astronauts the opportunity to train and to launch out of the Earth's atmosphere and to live in space. What we're hopeful is that there are going to be more opportunities. And what I mean by that is that right now there's only two ways, actually there's three ways to get to space. NASA's space shuttle, which is retiring this year, the Russian Soyuz rocket, and the Chinese have a rocket. So once the NASA shuttle retires, there will be only two ways to access space. The Chinese have only flown their rocket a few times. The Russians have flown their rocket since the 1960s. It's the safest transportation system we have to access space. And so the Russians, I would say, have the market cornered. The prices for our clients have doubled since Dennis Tito flew in 2001. As I said before, he paid $20 million. The ticket now is about $40 million plus. So because there's, call it a monopoly, our Russian partners have increased the cost. NASA also purchases seats on the Russian Soyuz rocket, and they pay about $56 million per seat. So their poor negotiation skills have forced us to increase our prices.
I see.
So what we're hoping is that there's more entrants into this field, meaning more manufacturers, non-government manufacturers. There's a company based in California called SpaceX. Mm-hmm. They're building a rocket. They had the first successful launch of their Dragon capsule. So they're building a rocket called the Falcon 9, they actually built this capsule called the Dragon, and that successfully reached Earth's orbit and orbited the Earth successfully and landed back in the Pacific Ocean. So we need more companies like that to have the capability of reaching Earth's orbit, and at that time, we feel as though the price will then decrease and provide more access to more people, not only clients like ours, but to universities, to corporations, people who want to do microgravity research. And once we're able to bring the price down, more people will be able to access it, and then we'll be able to have more discoveries based in space.
I see. So, piggybacking off, going back to part of what you said during your answer, I heard you mention the term non-career astronaut. Exactly how would you define that?
Well, that's, you know, people say that our clients are space tourists, and a lot more goes into traveling to space than just writing a very large check and hopping on a rocket. Our clients spend about 900 hours in Russia training for their mission. 900 hours equates to about 6 months. So it's not just, okay, I'm going to the Bahamas and I'm going to, you know, purchase my ticket on a plane or a boat and, you know, let's pack a bag and let's go. It's a lot more involved in that. And so that's what we say non-career astronaut is, because these people are spending an enormous amount of time taken out of their daily lives to devote themselves to learn about the instrumentation, to learn about the modules on the ISS, how they're able to live sufficiently and self-support themselves, not to be a burden on anyone else during the flight or during their time in space. And so that's why I call them non-career astronauts, because someone flying to space is really an astronaut, but we've just kind of termed that as, you know, professional, meaning like that's their career, versus someone who is just, you know, doing this as an adjunct.
Now, do you think that's going to change any if commercial space travel moves into a direction where people are just making suborbital flights to see what outer space looks like, and they're not necessarily going into an environment like ISS, where you have astronauts from around the globe that are there to do serious scientific study?
Right, so it's two different programs. One is suborbital space. You may have heard back in 2004 that this guy called Burt Rutan, he built a suborbital spacecraft, the first non-government spacecraft to reach space. And he won $10 million doing so. He did it in the Mojave Desert. I was there for the flight, and it was amazingly awesome. Now, that profile, you just touch space and you come back down. If you just think of an elevator,
right.
You're just going to the top, you're there for a moment, and you come back down. Now, orbit is when you're actually orbiting the Earth, and you need much more energy to be able to be captured into the Earth's orbit, gravitational pull, and all of that good stuff. So what we're hoping is that, you know, it's kind of like steps to space, that suborbital will lend itself to some research. It will lend itself to inspire people. We really need young people to be interested in STEM education, science, technology, mathematics, chemistry, physics. We need the kids today to be the leaders tomorrow. We need all the smart engineers and everyone to move our country forward. Well, I spent a lot of time talking to congressmen on Capitol Hill and talking about the need to inspire young people. And I say, you know, their concern usually is about, you know, jobs. You know, if jobs aren't affected in their district, then they're not really concerned about, you know, NASA's budget or funding commercial space. So I bring the example of inspiration in education. Who's inspiring today's kids? You know, back in the 60s, we had such an increase of people who wanted to go to be engineered because of Apollo.
Yes.
When Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, there are, you know, kids 6 feet that heard Sputnik making those beeps. We haven't had that inspiration for those kids. And I go up on Capitol Hill and I say, you know, our kids, you know, there's kids in Czechoslovakia and Estonia that are scoring better than we are in America in Earth in science education. I said that, you know, that has to change. We need to inspire our kids, and to inspire our kids, they need to see the joy. They need to see all that's there, and that would be a suborbital flight. I'm sure if you put a kid on a suborbital flight and they saw the black sky and they saw the curvature of the Earth, they would be very excited and probably hitting the books, wanting to actually go to the moon, go to Mars and explore. But we need those, as Obama said in the State of the Union, that Sputnik moment to get our country back on track.
So as people are watching the development of commercial space travel and hopefully at some point there would be a push both by the United States government, NASA in particular, as well as the FAA, and as well as Congress and the White House, and also by the media, because we know that the media will have to make it a point to borrow some time from the Justin Biebers and the likes to dedicate towards commercial space travel. But as things are coming along, and as you have your various different suborbital flights, let's go into that scenario for a minute. Because if we were on an airplane, when the commercial airline industry first became accessible to the common man, because in a lot of ways, the airline started out in a lot of ways the same way as commercial space travel is right now. At one point, it was only available to the rich, and eventually the cost came down and it became more affordable to the point where we are now, almost 100 years after the fact, where you can go on Expedia.com and get a ticket easily. Now, just kind of going forward a few years, looking for on the suborbital flights where they're just purely flying for tourism reasons or for exploratory reasons and staying out of the way of professional astronauts. Exactly what type of professionals are going to be needed to operate these types of flights?
There's a couple things I want to say to that question, and it's true. Aviation, commercial space exploration is following in a lot of ways what aviation did back in the early days. There's a lot of countries that wanted to just have government-owned aviation. That's why we have, you know, for instance, British Airways. England owned and operated as a government all the aviation. America took a different stance, and they had private entities building the airplanes like Boeing and so forth, but they had carriers that were operating the aircraft, and the operators didn't have enough money on their own because people couldn't afford the tickets. So the government said, we'll put 100 pounds of mail on each flight and help you basically subsidize the flight. So that's how they made it through. They're putting this one called airmail. They're putting 100 pounds of, guaranteeing 100 pounds of mail on each flight, helping them subsidize the flight. And then they became enough profitable enough that they didn't need the government's help. And now they're able to go on Expedia and get a really cheap ticket to wherever you want to go. Now, the same thing is happening with commercial space. You have people like Elon Musk and Robert Bigelow that are putting hundreds of millions of their own dollars into building this hardware. But they're also looking to NASA to help subsidize some of that cost as well. And so that's the reason why I'm going to Capitol Hill to try to advocate some of that money still going to commercial, that we're not relying on Russia and maybe China to get our astronauts into space. So, and then you said, you know, moving on to suborbital, what do we see as the operators of that? Hopefully, when your students are, I don't know, maybe parents or grandparents, they're going to be flying point-to-point transportation on suborbital space flight. It's quite conceivable that a flight from JFK to Tokyo right now is about, you know, 14 hours long or more. It would be 45 minutes. Instead of, you know, traveling at 30,000 feet above the Earth's surface as most commercial carriers do, you would be just popping up over the atmosphere, coming back down if you think of just a large arc. And it would totally revolutionize the way that we travel. And it would just, you know, bring a lot of happy faces, you know, people that have family or business around the world. And it would just make a big breakthrough. But as of right now, the first step is just having suborbital space flight available, and they're going to need pilots. They're going to need, you know, right now they have test pilots, but eventually they're going to need pilots for those suborbital spacecraft.
Okay. So now there are pilots. Now on your typical airline flight, you have pilots. On a 747, you might have a flight engineer, and you also have on your big huge passenger jumbo jets, you have flight attendants. You may have 1 to 5. Do you anticipate a group of suborbital flight paraprofessionals, kind of similar to the flight attendant, where it'll be their job to not pilot the plane, but kind of somewhere in between a mission specialist on a space shuttle and a flight attendant on an airplane, where their main objective is to look after the crew, after their personal wellness and safety, and some of the payload, if there is a payload, as well as handle some of the customer service issues that might arise on the suborbital flight?
Oh, most definitely. I think that, you know, right now the suborbital spacecraft that are in development are small, meaning they're, you know, like 6 passengers. But eventually, through time and evolution, that they will be bigger. So I think if you take the ground support and the flight support needed to run today's commercial aviation, you can apply that to commercial space flight, because you're going to need everything else. I mean, if you just look at the crew of the space shuttle, you know, you have your commander, your flight engineers, your mission specialist. All of that have to be replicated in the commercial atmosphere as well. And there's actually a really great exhibit that the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum downtown D.C. just opened. It's called Moving Beyond Earth. And has this great interactive that basically is geared to middle and high school students, and it asks you your interest and what you like to study and what you like to do when you're not in school, and then it matches you up with a astronaut job, whether that's being, you know, a mechanic to being in the mission control center to being a flight engineer to being the commander. It kind of you up to what they think, you know, what the computer, the little algorithm to think what's your best job in the space business would be. It's kind of fun to do that.
Do you, earlier we talked about some of the various different STEM subjects that are really important and that America is actually lagging behind in, very much so in terms of developing its future science and technology workforce. Now, let's kind of be specific for a minute and hypothetically look at the workforce of the space tourism / commercial space travel industry in 2025. Just kind of piggybacking off of that now, that would put today's kindergartners and first graders in those roles where they're staffing, where they're being those pilots, flight engineers, and flight attendants. What crucial lessons should we start insisting on placing inside of today's schools that would help prepare them for some of the skills that your current space professionals at Space Adventures have to use right now and are actually going to increase as the company's plans further develop?
Well, I think it's an overall appreciation for space exploration. As you said before, you know, the media displaces a lot of attention on things that are not essential in our lives, and, you know, celebrities and so on and so forth. And it's really for kids to be accepting of new ideas, for them not to just be brainwashed of what someone's telling them is cool and popular, for them to have their own ideas, for them to be inspired by something that's not straight in front of them entertaining them, for them to look at the stars and be inspired and think what is actually out there and how can I help explore that. You know, think of being a Christopher Columbus of their own time. And applying that inspiration and open-mindedness in the classroom and wanting and being enthusiastic of being in class and wanting to learn science, technology, you know, and pursuing advanced degrees in engineering, whether it's, you know, aerospace engineering, mechanical, anything like that. You know, today's, you know, the kindergartners, first graders, again, they're going to be our leaders, but your students are going to be the leaders as well. And there's a lot of things that, you know, we can't outsource to other countries. We have to have U.S. citizens working on basically classified materials, and that is, you know, a rocket. We can't have someone from another country working on a U.S. rocket. It has to be a U.S. citizen. And so if we don't have those kids studying those things, we're not going to have any rockets. We're not going to have any advancement, and our country will be stagnant, and people, you know, other countries will pass us by. And so that's what we need to instill in our kids. It's just the enthusiasm and the willingness to learn.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you think that the FAA is going to have to step in and place a set of regulations to kind of help shape the pedagogy of the training of future spaceflight crews, or do you think it's kind of at the point where the FAA kind of needs to have a hands-off policy and allow the market to develop the pedagogy?
Well, the FAA is already involved. There's actually a conference that starts tomorrow in D.C. called the FAA Commercial Spaceflight Transportation Conference. And they were involved, I mentioned before, the suborbital spaceflight that took place in 2004.
Right.
And the FAA was very involved in those flights, setting up the parameters, making sure, basically, they want to make sure that no one on the ground is going to be hurt by, you know, some spaceship falling. And so, you know, they're making sure that all the U.S. developers are being careful, not only with their crews and their machinery, but careful as in if there's any kind of, you know, mishap, that no one on the ground is going to get hurt, or hopefully. So as the industry evolves, the FAA will evolve as well, and I'm sure they're going to be involved with the training curriculum of the people, not only the flight and staff support, but also the people who are actually going to space. So it's a learning process for them. You know, this is something, you know, new. They've only had to deal with, you know, regular aviation, and so learning more about space flight and what all that involves is going to be a learning curve for them. But I'm sure they'll have all sorts of regulations for us.
How close are they to bringing the topic of licensing up? Because now they just pretty much give astronaut wings to anybody that passes the Tomorrow line. But has the topic of licensing and the type of regulations that they give to your typical commercial pilots, has that come up yet?
Well, they give launch licenses. So anyone who wants to launch from U.S. territory has to apply for a launch license. don't know all the exact details, but I know it's pretty rigorous of what companies have to go through to get that launch license. So far, there have only been two people who have actually launched with a private spaceship, and that was Brian Benny and Mike Melville, who flew with Spaceship One. So I'm not sure what kind of license they needed to actually pilot, but I know that they had to get launch licenses, and even, you know, unmanned rockets need launch licenses, but I'm not sure of all those details.
Okay. You are Ms. Taryn, thank you very much for your time. I think that'll do it for now.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks.
Right, bye-bye.